This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. When the FDA approved the use of cochlear implants in babies and toddlers a quarter century ago, it was considered to be nothing short of a medical miracle. Parents had an opportunity to introduce their deaf and hard of hearing children to sound and spoken language, and the children would conceivably be on par with hearing peers in their ability to communicate and succeed in the wider world. At the same time, many in the deaf community were taken aback, believing cochlear implants could eventually lead to the irrelevance of sign language and deaf culture, a community proponents say transcends nationality. So, 30 years later, where does the debate stand? And is there a growing acceptance in the deaf community of both points of view? Also, this note, this show is being transcribed and is appearing in real time on our website. You can head to whyy.org/radiotimes to view it there. Joining us for the discussion, Melissa Dragonak-Hawk, director of the Early Childhood Center at the Pennsylvania School for the Deaf. Students there learn in the language deemed appropriate for them, American Sign Language, as well as written and spoken English. Melissa happens to be deaf and is joined by two interpreters, Josh Steckel and Amanda Moyer, and you'll be hearing Josh's voice during the interpretation this hour. Welcome, Melissa.
Thank you.
Judy Sexton is director of the Clark Schools for Hearing and Speech in Philadelphia. At Clark, students use cochlear implants or hearing aids, and they learn by listening and speaking. Welcome to you, Judy.
Thank you.
And Louise Montoya is a professional counselor at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, where she works with children with hearing differences and their families. Nice to have you here, Louise.
Thank you.
So let's begin by trying to get a general sense of what deaf culture is. Melissa, describe what it is about deaf culture that makes it unique.
Deaf culture has their own beliefs, language, gatherings, art, literature, you name it. And language, we depend on American Sign Language. That's how the deaf community interacts. We experience commonalities in our shared experience. ASL as a language has been around for a long time, since America was founded. At that time, it was called sign language. It hadn't been called American Sign Language until in 1960, William Stokey, who is a professor at Gallaudet University, studied sign language and noticed some language patterns and decided to do some investigation and verified that it is a bona fide language, including phonics, morphology, syntax, and all the linguistic elements. And the deaf community was shocked at that point that it was deemed a language. And then as over time, it became more formally accepted. And now more and more courses are being offered in ASL at the deaf school and also in the hearing population. Deaf culture is part of our experience growing up.
Judy, children at the Clark School learn by listening and speaking. They have cochlear implants or hearing aids. So how does deafness or hearing difference fit into the worldview at Clark?
So what we focus on at Clark as we work with families, we believe that for families who use spoken language, it's really about an informed decision, that they have the right to get the information they need to make that informed decision, whether they want their child to listen and speak or to sign. And because the data is showing that 95% of families who have a child with a hearing loss are hearing, the question the families need to ask themselves is, do I want my child to be part of my community, my school, my church, and with the goal of having children in their neighborhood schools? At Clark, the goal is by kindergarten. So for families, that's important that they know they have the information they need to make a decision and that it is an informed decision and that the option today with the advent of the improvements in technology is that they can make a decision if they want their child to learn to listen and talk.
Louise, again, you are a counselor at CHOP. Tell us a bit about your background. You are not deaf or have a hearing difference, but your parents do.
Yes, both of my parents are deaf. My first language at home was American Sign Language. English is my second language. And I have lots of family members beyond my parents who are deaf or hard of hearing, which when we say hard of hearing, we're in our community, that means that the person has a hearing difference, but they choose to communicate through speaking, listening, and sometimes technology. So I have a different worldview. When I grew up, I thought it was quite normal to have a hearing difference, and that it didn't occur to me that people who had a hearing difference couldn't do anything, because I knew them. You wondered if a deaf or hard of hearing person could do something. I could introduce you to someone.
Let's talk about some of the latest in the cochlear implant technology. It's frankly amazing. The cochlear nucleus 6 sound processor is streamlined, it's wireless, it has Bluetooth capability, and the person using one actually can have an advantage over hearing people in that they can tune out background noise. But the question here is, will this sort of technology essentially render deafness or hearing difference obsolete? Melissa, what do you think about that?
So when a child is implanted, after they're born and they're exposed to language, whether it be spoken language specifically, if it's at an early enough age that they're implanted, then they can go ahead and continue that language development. If a child is born deaf and doesn't have any exposure to language whatsoever, they're already delayed. And so when we're talking about how the implants are really going to affect American Sign Language, over time, Judy talked about 95% of hearing parents have a deaf child. And then there are 5% that come from deaf families. And that's been kind of the same percentage over the years. And that those percentages will persist. Regardless if they're implanted, given hearing aids, that's still a very high percentage. There's an interesting parallel. ASL right now seems to be flourishing in the general community, not just the deaf community, but in the community at large. And it's offered at universities throughout the area, throughout the country. And in fact, the Modern Language Association here in America said that ASL is the third most commonly taught language in the country. 110,000 students around the country are enrolled. There are programs at high schools. And so people are more aware. So when they see a deaf person, they can now more and more have a conversation with that said person. And so unfortunately, a lot of these universities are doing very well, but these parents who happen to have a deaf child and don't know what to do at that point, they're wondering, are there other deaf people out there like my child? Will they have a normal lifespan? It's their first deaf child. It's their first exposure. And oftentimes, their experience is when, you know, all children are required to get audiograms here in America after they're born. And so the first thing they say is they failed the audiogram or you didn't pass your hearing test. That's the first experience. It's very negative. And so at that point they say, oh, well, there must be something wrong with my child. And that's the approach that they experience.
So what I'm hearing is perhaps some activists are saying the technology will render ASL irrelevant at some point. I'm not hearing that. I'm hearing that it is being taught and that it's flourishing. What is your experience, Louise? You're shaking your head. Is that a no, or are you just kind of...
No, I'm shaking my head in agreement that the hearing technology is not going to make deaf culture or American Sign Language irrelevant. The hearing technology is a major, wonderful set of tools that people who have hearing differences can add to their bag of tricks. And so I know that was a fear expressed specifically by the National Association of the Deaf back in the early 90s, for example, but they've since changed their position actually twice on cochlear implants, for example, and specifically. And so I see American deaf culture and American Sign Language continuing.
Judy, what is your experience at the Clark School? How are children, are they eventually going to be mainstreamed in terms of being able to work with listening and spoken language after they were at Clark?
They are, and as I'm listening to this conversation, as I'm part of this conversation today, and some of the things that we're hearing is that for children who are deaf or hard of hearing, when they get that diagnosis, parents have an opportunity to decide for their family what will work best for them. And so if a family's desired outcome is for their child to listen and speak, cochlear implants, it's not like putting on glasses and then you can see. There's a component to that that once a family chooses to for their child to have a cochlear implant, it's important that, and they want their child to learn to listen and speak, it's important that they find those professionals with the skill set and background knowledge of using listening and spoken language strategies.
We only have a couple minutes before the break. Mm-hmm. How does the technology work? Give us a bit of a primer.
So once it's decided for a child, depending on the degree of hearing loss, so if we're referring to cochlear implants, once a child is, it's determined that the child is a candidate for a cochlear implant, it's a surgical procedure where there's an electrode array, and the child receives the cochlear implant. That electrode array is surgically implanted in that part of the ear. And then several weeks later, the child gets a mapping where the audiologist, who is a specialist, will set the output of that cochlear implant for that particular child's needs. And then the child begins at Clark. They will begin a program of working with a professional with that skill set on how to begin to develop those listening skills. The implant will give them access. It is the development of those skills through a process where the child learns to use those parts of the brain responsible for speech.
So ASL is not taught at Clark, correct?
That's correct.
So why the focus on hearing and spoken language?
Again, it's an option that families would choose. And so for families who choose listening and speaking for their child, Clark would be the option for them because of the skill set of the staff, the model of the staff.
All right. Elizabeth Fiedler produced this hour of Radio Times, and she's also put together a compelling piece for WHYY's Health and Science program, The Pulse. Liz has talked to some families who include deaf children. We're going to hear two of those interviews after the break. We are talking this hour with Melissa Dragonet-Hawk, who is director of the Early Childhood Center at the Pennsylvania School for the Deaf. Melissa is deaf and uses American Sign Language. Interpreters Josh Steckel and Amanda Moyer are here this hour. You will hear the voice of Josh throughout the hour. Judy Sexton is director of the Clark School for Hearing and Speech in Philadelphia. Louise Montoya is a professional counselor at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And if you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 888-477-9499 or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowain. Welcome back to Radio Times. We are focusing on deaf culture and what it means to be deaf or to have a hearing difference. Since the advent of cochlear implant devices 30 or so years ago, how this might have impacted the use of sign language or might not have impacted the use of ASL. Our guests this hour include Louise Montoya, a professional counselor at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, where she works with children with hearing loss and their families. Judy Sexton is director of the Clark Schools for Hearing and Speech in Philadelphia. Students at Clark use cochlear implants or hearing aids. And Melissa Dragonet-Hawk is director of the Early Childhood Center at the Pennsylvania School for the Deaf. Melissa is deaf and uses American Sign Language. Interpreters Josh Steckel and Amanda Moyer are here with us this hour, and you will hear Josh's voice during the interpretation. And as always, lines are open at 888-477-9499. Radio Times producer Elizabeth Fiedler spoke with two Philadelphia area families with children who are deaf. We'll start with Liz's interview with Carolyn Linz, whose son Teddy was born deaf. He attended the Clark School and uses cochlear implants to hear. And Teddy now goes to a mainstream school.
We immediately started early intervention which is a speech therapist and teacher of the deaf coming out to your home and working with us therapy in the home. And then at 18 months, they have a program for early toddlers. And eventually he went to the preschool where he was there until he was six. And then he mainstreamed into typical school.
From when your son was very young, a little baby, you and your husband had already decided that you wanted his means of communication to be spoken English. Tell me about that and why that was important to you to have a son who could speak aloud.
Yes, I mean, it's the bonding that you want to have with your child, and the communication that we have in our family is spoken language. It's not sign language. And for us, we felt that that bond and that communication was important. We also had an older child at the time who has typical hearing, and we just always said that we wanted Teddy to have the same opportunities as his older brother and to be a part of our family and the greater community. And that was why that choice of communication for our family was the right choice.
So he went to Clark when he was young, and then at
six,
he started mainstream mm-hmm. schooling. I wonder if you were surprised that that was even possible.
Certainly, if you had talked to me as the mom of Teddy as a newborn, and even within the first, he received his first implant at age one and then his second one the year later, I'm not sure if I would be saying the same things that I'm saying now as Teddy's mom as a seven-year-old. Because, again, yes, we weren't sure whether he would be able to speak and go to a mainstream school. But because he went to Clark, he received the services there, and we saw the improvement with him. Because when you get a cochlear implant, people think it's like getting glasses where all of a sudden you're going to see. It's not that. The cochlear implants, your brain is working very, very hard as opposed to typical hearing kids in school, it comes naturally. And so when your brain is working doubly hard to hear and then learn the information you're at school, sometimes at the end of the day, he gets tired and he takes them off while he's watching TV. But at the other side to it is sometimes when he is scared, like when he goes upstairs and it's dark up to his room on the third floor, he takes his CIs off because I think the quiet is almost for him a comfort, or it makes him feel whereas to us it would seem the opposite.
But did you ever learn sign language or your husband? I know a lot of parents do learn it when their children are very young.
We actually did not learn sign language because we had chosen the path of listening and spoken language. However, Teddy does have friends at Sign, and it's always been a conversation. It's still an ongoing conversation about having someone come into our home, teach all of us. He has three brothers, my husband, myself, you know, grandparents. And, you know, if that's something Teddy wants to really explore, then we, like I said, we've already sort of started looking at that possibility and have other friends that have looked into it. But no, we do not know sign.
You mentioned that he has friends who sign. So does Teddy sign?
No, he doesn't. But he can sort of interpret it. Even our family has what we like to say our own sort of version, because when he doesn't have his implants on, he can't hear anything. So, you know, sometimes before bed or first thing in the morning, or if he's in the water and he doesn't want to use his aqua kit, which allows him to wear his implant in the water, which is a new advancement, which has been amazing for us because we are a family that spends a lot of time in the water. And when I couldn't communicate with him before the aqua kit, we had to make up our own sort of way to get information across.
Gestures.
Yes. Animated face. Yes.
How do you think that technology has changed? Do you ever think about it, how it's changed Teddy's life? If he'd been born 10, 20 years ago, his life could mm-hmm. or would have been very different.
I think about it all the time. In addition to his cochlear implant, he has an FM system, which he uses at school, mm-hmm. which is a way for the teacher to speak directly into his implant. So it blocks out all the peripheral sounds, you know, if kids are tapping or chairs are moving, to help keep him focused, which is just another added technology that I know a lot of other hearing aids and cochlear implant users have at school or in academic settings. And when people ask me about it, I always say that it would be a different world without his implants. So we feel lucky.
So the Lins family faces a difficult and common situation. We kind of touched on it before the break. The family overall is hearing, with one person who cannot hear. if they choose to forego implants, then the child risks being isolated within the family. And if they go with implants, then the child risks being alienated from traditional deaf culture. Louise, do you see this often in your practice? And if you do, how do you counsel families?
I absolutely do see it in the practice. And one of the things that I get the opportunity to meet with families usually months after diagnosis, which nowadays is within the first year of life. And one of the things I share with them is we have a lot of things that are available to help address any concerns that you have with your child. And when you're ready, we're here to help. But they often then are wondering, how can we help our child down the road to be okay inside their own skin? And in that first visit, I will say to families, your child, starting around age 4, needs to have regular and frequent contact with peers who communicate like them and see older children like them and use the same technology as them. They also need to have regular contact starting about age 4 with deaf and hard of hearing. And no offense to people in my generation, I'll say young adults who grew up, not us grammys and grandpops, but young adults who grew up and communicating the way they did and using technology starting at age 4 and throughout their entire childhood. And that is so necessary because a child who may grow up and have specialized services birth to 5 and then is mainstream may not have the opportunity. They may be the one and only child that has that difference in their school. And at the end of the day, the child's still deaf. At the end of the day, the child does have a difference that makes them different than their entire family, no matter how they communicate. And that child needs that emotional validation that I'm going to be okay. I'm not the only one in the world. And that the world is heterogeneous. You know, there's a variety. So we support families. And Clark and PSD do a wonderful job of this in the early intervention programs. Mm. But it becomes so important, you know, beyond the early intervention program and into adult life.
Melissa, again, what are the benefits of learning American Sign Language for a very young child?
Okay. So when the child is born, some children start learning language at the age of 3 or prior. That's a little bit late. So that exposure is so important. And that early exposure, I'll try and go through that and qualify that. So let's say we have a hearing family that's has a hearing child. They pick up all the ambient information, and they're processing all of that. When a child is deaf and has hearing parents, they're not getting that exposure. They go to the doctor. They are getting information from other professionals, and oftentimes, that has to do with how to fix their ear and augment sound, but not much about deaf culture and sign language. And so as time goes on, when we have the early intervention program and the parents are alerted to that and they're learning sign at the age of 3, it's very late.
3.
Yes. By and large, that's the around 3 to 5 years of age is where we really try to play catch up. And when those children are learning that, they're really on the level of a 1-year-old. As they progress, they learn more and more. And so I support parents, their autonomy to make decisions, but oftentimes they are not getting the total information about the technology and the culture that is available to them.
Why choose American Sign Language, Melissa?
Not all children have access to hearing. Some do, and it really does depend. But if a child has a profound hearing loss, we need the earliest exposure possible to language. And so language is integral to help them develop their cognitive skills, which will lead to their academic success down the road. If a child has a cochlear implant, we need to expose them to ASL so they're bilingual and they have that added benefit. I think it's and really important for a child to learn both languages, to learn how to sign and listen and speak. And so then they're able to navigate and see, and so that they can kind of code switch. They can speak with their hearing peers and sign with their deaf peers. And that's just a wonderful opportunity for them.
Okay. Judy, we're going to get to you in a minute. I'm looking at the time. I just want to get Liz's piece in. So just okay. Give us a moment or so here. We've got her second piece. Elizabeth Fiedler spoke with Sam Zwislak, whose 8-year-old daughter, Sophie, attends the Pennsylvania School for the Deaf. Sophie has a cochlear implant, and she speaks and uses sign language.
Tell me about your daughter. When did you find out about her hearing, and what did you think?
We found out relatively soon. In Pennsylvania, they do something that's called a newborn hearing screen. And shortly after birth, while we were still in the hospital, Sophie did not pass the newborn hearing screen. And I think we got the final, I don't know what the appropriate term is, diagnosis, I guess, of her being profoundly deaf. At about 2 months, I think she was about 8 weeks old.
What did you think?
I guess we were kind of sort of shocked, but shocked in a way because, you know, when you're pregnant and you're getting ready to have a baby, there are hundreds and thousands of things that you're thinking about or that people are, you know, telling you about or that you're being tested for. And deafness was never on the radar. It's, you know, we don't have anyone else in the family who is deaf or anyone who was born hard of hearing. We have family members who are starting to lose their hearing, but as far as being deaf, we hadn't had anyone on either my side of the family or my husband's side of the family. So you really just, you kind of sit with it for a minute because you're kind of like, oh, well, wow. Out of all the things in the world that someone could tell you about your child, they're going to say your child's deaf. But I think we were more okay with it than maybe other people.
And Sophie's now 8. She's in third grade at Pennsylvania School for the Deaf. Tell me about that and about the cochlear implants. I understand that was a very difficult decision to decide whether to do it or not. Tell me about that.
Yes, it's a very, very difficult decision. It's a hot topic. It's a controversial thing. We didn't ever want our daughter to think that she's broken or, you know, not complete somehow and that she needed to be fixed. We wanted to make sure that she knew, you know, we're not trying to fix something on you to make you be a particular way. But at the same time, there is this really neat technology that if you're the appropriate candidate and if you do it soon enough, children who are deaf have access to sound and can use their voice if they choose to speak. I say it that way because I stress that it really should be a choice. And this is where it gets difficult because I feel that the choice isn't necessarily up to the parents. The problem is that an infant can't make that particular choice. And an infant doesn't have the information yet of knowing which community do I want to be a part of. How do I want to communicate? Do I want a device? Do I not want a device? There's also the not knowing of how well a device will work. What is that going to sound like? Is it actually going to sound like a language? Or is it just going to be this loud banging noise in your head that you want to take off of your body? Is it something that's going to make you feel like you're not you? These are all things that I hope people do consider and do understand that ultimately at the end of the day, that child's going to grow up regardless and they're going to find out who they are. And it might be hearing, it might be deaf. And we have chosen to accept that, you know, Sophie very well, she already identifies as being deaf and we're comfortable with that. She's looking forward to going to the Deaf University. She wants to go to Gallaudet. We're very proud of that.
So what is Sophie's primary means of communication? Primarily sign language, also spoken?
Sophie is an amazing code switcher. And code switching is when a person uses whichever language it is that you use. And what's really funny is that even though my husband and I have learned how to sign, and we sign to her all of the time, she does not sign back to us. So CI on or off, she will always respond to us in spoken English. And I have asked her on many occasions, why don't you sign with mommy and daddy? And she has answered me outright, mom, because you're hearing. And to her, yes, it is very matter of fact. Why would she sign to me if I can hear?
And we thank Elizabeth Feeler for those pieces. Here it is. The question is, the crux of the matter for many people is there's a choice to be made, and the person involved cannot make that choice. The parent has to make that choice. Judy, where do you go with that when you talk to parents at the Clark School? And this is where deaf activists, a lot of them, they have such a hard time with this decision.
Right. And for families that are coming to us and they're coming with this new identification of that their child is deaf or hard of hearing, there are many decisions they have to make. And they also have this new information, and their child may be the first deaf person that they have ever met. And so in addition to giving them the information about listening and spoken language, we also encourage families to look at all of their options. We feel very strongly about this at Clark, that in order for families to make a decision that's right for their family, that they need to be informed and they need to know about all of their options. We also will connect them with other families. And so we work through this process. If in the end the family decides at that particular moment in time they want their child to listen and talk, then Clark would be an option for them. But the other piece of that is that we also have the discussion with families is that they also have the opportunity to change their mind.
And we're coming up on a break, so I have to stop you for just a moment. We're going to pick up after the break here. Judy Sexton is director of the Clark Schools for Hearing and Speech in Philadelphia. Louise Montoya, a professional counselor at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Melissa Dragonock-Hawk is director of Early Childhood, the Early Childhood Center at the Pennsylvania School for the Deaf. And we've got calls and comments coming in, so we will try to get to them as well here on Radio Times. Welcome back to Radio Times. Our focus this hour is on deaf culture and what it means to be deaf since the advent of cochlear implant devices some 30 or so years ago. Our guests include Melissa Dragonock-Hawk, director of the Early Childhood Center at the Pennsylvania School for the Deaf. Melissa is deaf and uses American Sign Language. Interpreters Josh Steckel and Amanda Moyer are here with us this hour, and you will hear Josh's voice during the interpretation. Judy Sexton is director of the Clark Schools for Hearing and Speech in Philadelphia. Students at Clark use cochlear implants or hearing aids. And Louise Montoya, a professional counselor at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, where she works with children with hearing loss and their families. And as always, lines are open at 888-477-9499. Or you can send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org. And before we get to the calls, has anybody watched Dancing with the Stars and Niles DeMarco? Who here is, maybe I'm the only one? Okay.
Oh, I've been watching.
All right. So, Melissa, okay. So, he is also, aside from being in the finals of this music competition, this dance competition, he is a deaf activist who feels very strongly that deaf children should not necessarily be given cochlear implants. He thinks that it is depriving deaf children of the opportunity to learn ASL and to be immersed in deaf culture. He does not have the implants. So again, it comes down to this choice. Melissa, the word deprived struck me as being a really strong word. It's Niall's word, his choice, but what do you make of that?
Well, it's not just Niall's view. The deaf community is very concerned that there are many students that are very language delayed, and so they've missed all that early exposure. In the past few years, we've noticed a higher prevalence of children at schools, at deaf schools, middle schools, and they're enrolling in middle schools and not prior. And we're trying to want, and we notice that they have been deprived of language before they enroll. They've been in mainstream settings. They've just tried, you know, gotten by. And so it's been mentioned talking about, you know, learning from your peers, and that is so essential. And as they do that and socialize as they get older at the age of 8, then they can kind of form their identity and realize that some people are different than them. They might be hearing, I'm deaf. There must be a difference. I can speak perhaps, but as the child gets older and they become a teenager, they do a lot of introspection and their family becomes involved. And so that's when families tend to struggle with their children and that rapport, and the child wonders why they're different. And then when they go to the deaf school, it's an enlightening experience. They learn ASL. They become a whole person. Without language, you know, it just has to be at an early age. I mean, regardless if they're going to sign or speak, I think the exposure to both language, have that bilingual approach, and then really they can just progress, and then they can decide where their journey takes them. Sophia, who you mentioned, her mom asks, why didn't she sign with me? And the child said, because you're hearing. She's already made those decisions. She's already a whole child. She has that confidence. She has that identity. And I'm envisioning her in the future. I mean, she has such potential. She could be a doctor, a lawyer, anything she decides because of that self-actualization. There was no deprivation there.
Louise?
So I think this discussion probably is missing the information of two points that I can think of. One, you know, at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, we're focusing a lot here in this discussion today on cochlear implants, deaf culture. But at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, we treat and see a very wide range of children that have any amount of hearing difference. The vast majority of the children that we work with have some hearing loss, but have wonderful access, constant access, without their technology or with their technology, to spoken language around them and the sounds around them. So, for example, my husband, who has hearing loss in both ears, he uses English and Spanish, and without his hearing aids, he does really well, and he doesn't feel deprived of not having American Sign Language. We have children that don't have hearing loss, you know, have typical hearing in one ear, where they have full access, and hear some, or maybe not fully, in the other ear. So I think the discussion has to keep in mind when we're talking about the deprivation. It's a very small percentage of all of the children and adults that would fit into the category where visual language is the primary mode. The other thing I think that's missing is that either option, and right now we're sort of making it dichotomous between spoken language and technology or American Sign Language, which in Sophia's case, she's using American Sign Language and spoken language. Either option for families and children are not carefree options. Both of them require an immense amount of work by the child, the educators, and the family. And sadly, we have children that, whatever communication method they use, are not getting all of the supports that they need. And whether they're in a sign language environment or whether they're in a spoken language environment, they have language deprivation because the work isn't there. And it's a lot of work for families and educators.
I am promised that we will get to the telephones, and let's do that because we have a lot of calls. Mark in Philly, welcome to Radio Times. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Thank you for your time. I do have a question, and I think Sam may have already addressed it, but I'm going to go ahead with it. I'm just concerned and puzzled as the emphasis of having to make a choice. Why does it have to be this or that? Why can't it be both? You know, as a deaf person myself with a deaf son that was mainstreamed, I was shocked because my son was kept apart from other deaf students. Even though he signs and they would not, the stress that he had in mainstream, you know, he was not allowed to meet with those kids. And I don't understand why there has to be a separation. And also with recent research from Gallaudet, the VL2, they support having the implants is okay, and they can still thrive in both. Why can't they do both?
All right. Thank you so much for the call to Radio Times. Judy Sexton, we're hearing it's not always an easy transition to mainstream.
So when we look at a baby, a newly diagnosed baby, there's a very small window of opportunity, as we've heard Melissa mention, so that during that critical period of time when the brain is most plastic, that we want to look at, and there are guidelines that are out that say that if a family's choosing ASL, then they need to have a professional with that expertise to work with that family and that child. If they are choosing listening and speaking, then they have a right to have that professional with that expertise and knowledge to work with that family. And because we have this small window of time as that window is closing for language development, that's where a family needs to make a decision. And as we always tell families, you can change your mind. But it's important, whatever option that that family chooses, whether it's listening and speaking or whether it's sign language, that they have a right to that professional with that expertise. Because we heard Louise say that it's a lot of work, whether you're choosing ASL or whether you're choosing listening and talking. It is a lot of work for the families, and it's a commitment.
Are the resources there, Melissa, especially for poor families?
Well, I would say the early intervention programs have plenty of resources to help those families. But they're not given exposure to an equal side, a balanced position. It's more just what's out there is really more focus on English. And if we're given an equal stance, I think it would make a difference. And so one thing I'd like to mention is Mark, the caller, talked about the VL2 program at Gallaudet. That's visual language, visual learning is what it represents. And it's a program at Gallaudet University that was just founded. And they're doing a lot of research right now. And one thing that really struck me was something that was published in 2012. It's Hansada is the last name, who was from Iran and did an experiment with two different groups. All the children were 7 years old, deaf and hard of hearing groups. They were both exposed to listening, and then one group had hearing parents, one group had deaf parents. For 4 years, they were tracked, and there were interesting results. The deaf children who had deaf parents were far superior to their deaf peers that had hearing parents. And we wonder why that is. And so we looked at that. And basically, it's just that they had that visual language exposure. They had that linguistic foundation. And they were able to develop speaking and listening as well. And they far, you know, outreached their other peers.
Was that because they got it when they were young in the home, they had the education? Or are the resources, I guess, available
exactly right.
to, okay, that's the question to children in the community. All right, Judy, a comment from you, and then I'd like to get back to the phones.
Right, and I think that's an important point to make, that once a family makes that decision, they need to have someone with that expertise. And so when we're looking at this research, we're not quite sure who were those professionals working with that family. The other point I did want to make is that more and more children and families are choosing to use this technology, whether it's hearing aids or cochlear implants. So we have, if children are identified, amplified, and in early intervention by 6 months, those are the children that are more likely have the skills commensurate with their peers to move into the mainstream. We recognize that. We also recognize, for instance, at Clark, we have a mainstream program. So we have teachers of the deaf because, as Louise said, they will always be deaf. But how do we support these speaking deaf children as they're moving into the mainstream? So there are mainstream teachers of the deaf that are going in. And also we need to look at, and Clark is doing this as other programs are doing this, is now that the children are in the mainstream, there may only be two children in a school who have cochlear implants. They need to come together with other children who have cochlear implants, who have hearing aids,
sure.
and who are speaking. And so, for instance, this last Sunday, Clark had a listening walk at the zoo. We had over 1,000 children who use cochlear implants or hearing aids, who are speaking. There's a Pennsylvania chapter of the Alexander Graham Bell Association where we're hosting events, but it's moving at a fast pace, and we're trying to do the best that we can do across the country.
All right, we're reaching the top of the hour here, so let's try to get a comment in. Neil emails, I work closely with many of the panelists, and their passion for successful outcomes for deaf children is clear. I grew up listening and using spoken English, but I was exposed to ASL very early on. Sadly, experience is not universal. For a while, my mother signed better than me. What that experience taught me, however, was that having options is so crucially important for all deaf children, and the medical model of trying to fix or normalize people has failed deaf children immensely. What would it take for the broader field of deaf education to come to a consensus, or is the field just too polarized? Melissa, what do you think about that? Is consensus or polarization?
Well,
it's a deep question.
Oh boy. Louise, if you want to chime in.
Could I please? I grew up in an era where this polarization was the definition of my family life. And I think we all grew out of it. And my hope and wish for the deaf, the hearing, and the hearing different community is that we all grow out of it, and we accept whatever works for the individual is what is most effective, and that an individual that has many tools in their toolkit is really awesome. You know, what we're talking about today is a very, very complex yet very individualized decision for every family that has a child. And so I've seen a lot of growth in our polarized, quote, communities. But I've also seen much more acceptance. And my hoping is that we continue to go that way.
I was reading a little bit about Gal Yudet, and it seems as if among the young on the campus, there is a coming together of all sorts of different choices. Is that your understanding? Melissa, are you in touch with the Gal Yudet community?
Yes, I am. At Gal Yudet, the demographic is changing. There are more and more students going there from mainstream programs. There are several students, they learn ASL for the first time at Gal Yudet. And it's quite an experience that they wish they had long before. One student, I happened to go to the Early Hearing Detect, EHDI, conference about 3 or 4 years ago, and there was a panel there of Gal Yudet students from various backgrounds. One came from a deaf family, one was implanted later in life, one was implanted earlier, you name it. And one person, there was a woman who got up, and she spoke without signing at all. She said, I went to Gal Yudet, and then I found who I was as a person, as a whole person, and I wish I had that before. When she stepped out of the panel, she signed. And I thought that was really good.
Well, we'll have to end it on that note with a lot of folks who didn't get on the air with their calls and questions. Sorry about that. We could have gone another hour. Melissa Dragonock-Hawk, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Along with interpreters Amanda Moyer and Josh Steckel, we heard Josh's voice. Melissa is the director of the Early Childhood Center at the Pennsylvania School for the Deaf. Judy Sexton, a pleasure as well.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Judy is director of the Clark Schools for Hearing and Speech in Philadelphia, and Louise Montoya, great to have you here.
Many thanks.
Louise is a professional counselor at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. As always, we invite you to check out our Facebook page, whyy.org/radiotimes. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowitz.